Welcome to the Polarstern podcast. Just living isn't enough, said the butterfly. One must have sunshine, freedom, and a little flower, wrote Hans Christian Andersen. Creating environments where people experience well-being, thrive as humans, and even deliver high performance is no easy task. In this episode, Imran Rehman, founder and CEO of Kokoro, shines a light on how to think about failure, what makes a good team, how to create inspiring learning environments, and ultimately give people the opportunity to be the humans they really are. You might be confused right now. This episode is going to be in English. Please bear with me, it's not my native language. Nevertheless, I hope you get as inspired as I got. If not, that's okay too. So, here's my conversation with Imran Rehman. What makes a good team?
That's a very, very good question. So what makes a good team? You know, people, you know, I get asked that question a lot. Like, you know, is there actions? And I also get asked the question, are there 10 things, 5 things teams do that make them high functioning, high performing?
Like a bullet list.
Yeah, a bullet list. And I mean, we've looked at hundreds of teams and we keep coming back to something very, very, very simple. And what it is it's almost the way, it's not what they do. All teams do things. Teams that are not functioning well do the same things as teams that are functioning really well. Mm-hmm. But what is the difference between a team that is high functioning and a team that isn't? Well, we keep coming back to, the thing I keep finding is it's the way they think. So that gets people, doesn't it? Then they always think, well, it's not actions. And they say, well, look, it's the way they think about mistakes. A high-functioning team makes more mistakes than a team that isn't high-functioning.
Well, that's interesting.
See, isn't it? And what they do is when they make a mistake or something fails or there is an error, the way they frame that as a learning problem mm-hmm. or a learning opportunity. So it's the way they think about it. When somebody joins the team, it's the way they think about structures. Mm-hmm. So a high-functioning team says, let's break the structures so we make space for Rafael and Imran mm-hmm. to find their space. Very often teams that are not functioning well with a good sense of belonging have an expectation that you are new, you find your own space. Mm-hmm. So to answer your questions in a very simple way, it's not what you do, it's the way you think, and the way you think, it's the way you act on it, and the way you change and able to adapt and respond to your context.
Mm-hmm. So a high functioning team, by that you mean a team that actually achieves results and gets things done, or what's high functioning context?
Yeah, well, it does mean that it's got impact. Mm-hmm. A team that has any form of impact is from the high functioning. Mm-hmm. And I know lots of people use the word high performance, and I like that term, but I like, if I use the term high performance, and I like to have the term healthy high performance.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because performance is, especially nowadays, often associated with unhealthy behavior.
Yeah, well, we've worked with teams where they have been high-performing and in a healthy way. And what we keep finding is these teams realize that well-being comes first and then comes performance. If well-being is not a topic in the team, mm-hmm. if the team does not take time to take care of the team and the environment, then there will be no high performance. If there is high performance, then it's under pressure. Bad pressure, and very often it's done through grit and not through building resilience in the team. It's mm-hmm. done through push, 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 push. Mm-hmm. And what happens is at one point a team like that runs out of energy.
Okay.
And it falls to pieces. So a team that is healthy will make it a topic, and there will be a mindful team. They will then watch out for each other. If somebody in the team is overdoing it or going down a rabbit hole, losing themselves and forgetting what is the essence of the team, the purpose of the team, you know, why do we exist? Why are we doing what we do? You know, and our mission is to deliver on this. Then that person will be called out and say, look, stop. And I think that's it. It's teams that are nice to each other are not necessarily a sign of a healthy, high-performing team. Teams which are kind to each other, that means there are days when there are difficult conversations happening by saying, you're going too far. Stop. Come back. You're ahead of us. Go with us.
So could you elaborate on that difference between being nice and being kind?
Two words I find. Okay, cool. So they're very, for me, they're fundamentally different, because when you translate them into a language like German, Spanish, Urdu, Hindi, they don't come across as very different.
Okay.
But they are. So nice is the general surface sort of pleasantries you exchange with people, like, hey, how are you today? You know, oh, the weather's nice. And you have your, you say something and you move on. Kindness involves things like, how generous are you with your time? Kindness has to do with how much you care, really care. Kindness is about listening with all your body when you listen to somebody. And kindness has to do with saying I give first before I take. And if you look at most organizations today with their performance systems and the way they have been set up, you will find that performance systems are set up for people to take and not give. Therefore, you'll find very often cultures which shows, you know, where people are just nice to each other all the time, but they're not kind to each other. And then once the niceties and the nice stuff gets out the way, you realize sometimes how difficult this culture is, how toxic this culture is, or you start realizing, hey, this culture has a real problem once you get past the false harmony.
So let me see if I got it. So being nice is about creating a superficial atmosphere of niceness, essentially. Feels good, of harmony.
Harmonious collaboration.
Yeah.
So I call it as well brittle kisses.
Brittle kisses, okay.
That's another way of
a good metaphor. Yeah? And being kind is about actually caring about the... It's more or less the implicit aspects of work, I guess. And that also means having difficult conversations, talking about the things that don't work well and that might hurt someone in the most extreme case, or make you feel underappreciated, all these things. So going beyond the surface layer of niceness and opening essentially your heart to the working environment, right?
See? There you go. Then you already start moving into a space where you think, okay, so what do we need to do?
Yeah.
So it happens.
Yeah.
And humans are wonderful, because if you do create the environments for them, it happens. There doesn't have to be any telling. Let me talk about the three things we have found that have really... what we also focus on to help individuals, whether they are, you know, leaders, whether they are members of teams, whether they are people just beginning to start in the working world and are part of their first team. And what we keep coming back to is this whole idea of, like, how do you create a safe environment? And when you have a safe environment, you know, a lot of people call it psychological safety. And a lot of people don't get that, you know, what is psychological safety? Psychological safety is what two people have between them, and it's called trust. Yeah? Psychological safety is for the group. And it's whether, when you just mentioned how I can open up and be vulnerable, it's how that's rewarded by the group. You open up and say, I'm having a problem, and the group goes, thank you for sharing that. Let me tell you my problem. Can we talk about all of them? That's psychological safety. When that happens, then things move. And psychological safety creates speed. So it's fascinating to see when suddenly when the group creates this safety. So if you want to call it, not the trust at the individual level, but creates this sense of trust at the group level, then things move.
And actual...
People are able to open up and speak up and say, this is my problem. I've got a problem with the way you're doing that. Look, could we sit down and find out a better way? Because look, I know that you're the best in the team at it. But look, I think we could also learn from you. And you could learn from us. Where do we find that space to make that happen? When can we talk about the tough issues in the team? Can I ask for help if I'm struggling, even though you think I should be able to do it myself? Now, all these underlying expectations we create, and to create that safety is paramount. And you can start with very simple things. So one way, like we do with the teams we work with, is we start off with looking at, say, for example, how is information passed around the team? Okay, so the way information is acquired, the way information is then processed, and the way information is then forwarded to the next person or to the next team. If that works, psychological safety goes up. And those are the things we look at. That's the first thing we look at. The second thing we look at to get the environment going is this whole sense of belonging. In psychology, it's called belongingness. And, it's an essential need for every human to find their part. But there's three things that really, really stand out in this. It's like, if you're part of a team, do I feel important? Do I have an identity in this team? That could be clarity in my role, what I do, how I do it. Do people look at me and go, wow, this person can do this. I think it's their strength. And that's why we have them in this team. And the final part is your ability to connect to people. And that is what creates that sense of belonging. So if you have the safety, if you have the belonging, that still is not enough. If you only have one, then you don't have enough of the other, then you also have a problem. So if there's lots of safety, but no belonging, you have the bro culture, like you find in the startup world. Yeah, because the bros are always transparent, candid, open, tell you it like it is, give me solutions, don't give me problems. And they very often hurt people along the way because they don't rally people around and build this sense of belonging. And they walk over people and they become very toxic cultures because they also scale very fast. And that is no mistake of the founders. Their intentions are good. But what they forget is belonging is critical as well as the psychological safety that is already there. And then comes the next part, isn't it? The final part you find in the environment, and this is necessary, is this whole idea of of flow, being in the zone. How do you get people into that zone so they can sort of find their way? And that very often has to do with concepts like deep work. Finding out your focus, finding out what task I need to do next? And is it clear that the task I do next will have impact? And do these tasks energize me? Or am I going to burn out or bore out? All these terms. And when you bring all three together, then you have to start thinking about, wow, how do we keep on top of all this? How do we keep, as a team, how do we keep on top of this? And for a department head, or say if you're set up like that, whatever structure you have for your teams, how do I create an environment as a leader so all my teams can do this? And then you go to organizational level, and you go, okay, now I've got 8 departments, I've got 150 people running around all over the place, how do I do it for them? And then along comes somebody else from outside and says, but I also want to collaborate with you. Okay, so how do we make sure that we keep all our organization working, but also collaborate with external people in the best way, and they understand that we are doing the best thing possible for them. So you can see then to scale these things requires then some thinking. And you see, you come back to what I said earlier on, is it's not what you're doing, but very often how do we keep people thinking,
mm-hmm.
making then the environment in which they can speak up, discuss, make the right decisions. So having the right conversations, making the right decisions, and then acting.
Mm. So it's not as a leader that you release a guideline, this is how we do things now, but it's actually touching people to think in a certain way that's going to build an organization from the ground up.
Yeah, you know, like guidelines, principles, all these things. You have a purpose and maybe some guidelines to help you bring that purpose to life. And I think that's great, have those.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the hardest part is to create the accountability
mm-hmm.
and responsibility in the teams and the people, isn't it? So like you as a leader, you got those guidelines in place. Maybe you created them and gave them to people and said, this is the way we're going to do it. Or maybe you created it bottom up with all the people involved. So you create a good sense of belonging,
mm.
yeah, amongst the people, and they understand them and they think, yeah, I believe in them. But, well, where do you then start making the spaces so accountability can be part of the process?
Mm.
I think those are really, really important. So you have to start thinking in spaces and think, okay, how do we bring this accountability to life? How can I talk about a difficult thing to you, Raphael, and make it feel comfortable?
Mm-hmm. Sounds quite challenging.
Isn't it? And it's not that anybody... Am I good at it? Are you good at it? No. Collectively, we're good at it.
Okay.
But I individually am not. It's only collectively. So that gets into a different space now, doesn't it? You have to start mm-hmm. thinking about that mm-hmm. now. What happens between humans very often? You have more expertise than me. I have more education than you. I am taller than you. You are more experienced than me. And then you get into this sort of space where people say, well, I should be the subject matter lead. And you dominate the conversation,
mm-hmm.
But you're not taking care of everybody else's strengths. And that means everybody else loses.
And I'm then starting to think in dimensions that actually don't really matter for any of these three pillars that you mentioned, right?
No, they don't. Because what happens then, the next step, think about the next step. So you decide then, okay, nobody can be dominated and nobody can be show dominant behavior. All people are equal, eye to eye.
Hmm.
And then you go into this space of making it democratic. And then everybody has to make a consensus. But through giving up a little bit, you know, by saying, okay, then I'll live with it.
Hmm.
The minute that happens, everybody loses because everybody has to give up something they're not. So that doesn't work either. Compromise does not work. So domination doesn't work. Compromise doesn't work.
Now, these are two very important ideas you just mentioned.
Yeah,
compromise does not work.
No.
Neither does domination.
You try to dominate your partner's personality.
Yeah.
Yeah, her identity. Or his identity, or whatever term you want to use,
yes.
You know, their identity.
Yeah.
But you try to dominate it. You're going to find there's going to be a struggle.
Yes.
If you then both compromise, something's going to happen at one point in your relationship.
Yes.
What you do then is, where do you go then? If those are not the way, and how do you integrate so all strengths are taken care of? And that's where this diversity, equity, and inclusion thing comes in.
Mm.
And one of the ways we found works is what they call the third space. And the third space is then we collectively build a new space.
Mm-hmm.
And third space comes out of post-colonial theory.
Okay.
It's out of the world of literature. And that is a space where many people ignore and don't look because it's not business. What can we learn from the people that read books? You know, they've only been doing them for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I found they have figured out many answers, but nobody is willing and nobody has seen the way they do it. And they have always said, look, in the third space, that's where it gets interesting, because you can't dominate, you can't compromise. Everybody's allowed to be 100% of who they are, as long as they are not doing something illegal in the sense of I am hurting you physically, mm-hmm. abusing you psychologically. Those things obviously are a given,
yes.
that you're not doing that, but you are being a human in this space. Then how do you bring people together?
The third space. Yet compromise and domination are the two leading theories of organizational collaboration. That's what you see in
I think they were,
most
but they,
spaces.
Yeah, I would say it was. And I think there is a movement towards, I think this little virus has helped us to realize that we can't carry on like that. And there is a movement towards what I would now say is called a developmental organization,
mm-hmm.
an organization that is in continuous development, that is continuously responding and adapting. And I think there are then degrees of power that you can set these organizations up in. So you could have very distributed, networked organizations, right? You know, and then from there, that work very autonomously.
Mm.
And then from there, all the way back to maybe a small organization that is quite hierarchical, small, and works.
Mm.
It doesn't need to be autonomous. It doesn't need to be distributed. So there's no right form of organization in that sense.
There can't be in this logic, because if I'm 100% a human and 100% who I am, then this is going to be a very diverse range of leadership styles, of organizational structures, of human beings, essentially. And so there can't be one right organizational form or leadership style to govern all of these.
Yeah, things. What there can be is an agreement around the point of view
mm-hmm.
of who, what we do and who we are.
Yeah.
So, if you've got 10 people and all 10 people want to do something different, then you're not going to create most probably an effective organization.
Yes.
If one wants to say, well, I want to have a pizzeria. The next one says, well, I want to make shoes. And the next one says, well, I want to have a supermarket. And the next one then says, no, well, look, do you know what? I want to open a tourist office.
There's no belonging in there.
There isn't. Then there are 10 separate businesses. But how do you build an organization that maybe works in the space of, say, products for the household, but then says, well, for the household and the office, and says, well, how could we serve an organization where if one of our employees has a great idea with one of our products and wants to build a business out of it, how can we support them so they can make that a reality? Mm-hmm. So there has to be a point of view there. So well, look, the point of view could be a very simple one by saying, look, we have two principles. If you're going to set up a business as part of our organization, then they've got to follow these two principles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Number one, it's got to make everybody in that company feel like an entrepreneur. And number two, it's got to be every decision you make in this company has to do with the customer you're serving
mm-hmm.
and not about you. And then we'll support you as a company to build a new business. So what's really important also is then to have a point of view. And I like the term point of view because I think that's what creates inclusive environments. So inclusive environments, I think, are key in any leadership style today. I think many leaders today have no clue how to create inclusive environments. That's where it begins with. It's about how can you be inclusive.
Got so many questions right now.
Okay.
Let me first start off with, so from my personal experience, which is very limited. I've got the sense that not a lot of people know who they are. Not a lot of people have that connection to their true self. Maybe it's because organizations they work in, because most people work in some form of organization, haven't given them the space to develop that connection, to get to know themselves and to realize it. But how can I... I'm a very engaged leader and I want to develop that organization, want to put it into this third space, but I have a lot of my whole staff doesn't know who they are. How can this work? How can there be belonging if the individuals don't have a sense of what they want to belong to?
I think this could be, I mean, there's some fundamental truths you have touched upon. Like this whole idea, do humans really know who they are? Or are we just conditioned? And I think there is, starting off there, you're going to go down a rabbit hole and you're not going to help anybody. So every reality, start off with just the concept that every reality is okay. Whether you know you are the person you are or not, it's okay. That's great. Let's start there. What's more important for any leader today is to ensure that what happens to each and every person is not a comparison between them and somebody else, because that's what breaks people. If I keep comparing you to, hey, why can't you be like Johnny and Julie over there? They're fantastic. Why can't you be like Muhammad and Sonia over there? They're better than you in the way you, in writing reports. And I'm going to benchmark your team up against the team in the US, which have done 4 times the amount of revenue than you have. It shouldn't make you feel shit, but maybe you can learn from just being compared to the best and you are at the bottom.
I already feel like shit.
Good. Can you see that? Mm. That's called social comparison. Mm. And you see cultures do that all the time. Like parents say, well, why can't you be like Raphael? He's such an amazing son. You know, and you're like going to your parents, well, look, why don't you ask me how I could be, you know, a better person? Why don't you have a conversation with me and stop comparing? Any leader today should not really be looking at social comparison. So if every reality is okay, then the next question is, help that person to see where they were a week ago and where they are today. Help that person to see where they were a month ago and see where they are today. And encourage that conversation. Hey, how's it going with you? Where are you? What's going on? Hey, I saw 3 months ago that you were struggling in writing reports. Hey, you've done 10 in the meantime. What's been going on there? Tell me. Tell me your story. Tell me your moments where it happened. Tell me when it clicked. Tell me when the penny dropped. Tell me. Speak to me.
What if it goes into the other direction? If that person writes 10 reports less?
Well, then do you understand? But that's beautiful. You've got data. You've got wonderful data. If that person writes 10 reports, you're thinking, what's going on here? They've always told you that you're going to be a great report writer at school and university, haven't they? And you're realizing you're not. That's the best thing we have found out in the last 4 weeks. So what you go towards is temporal comparison. And temporal comparison is what they call the is-is comparison, not the is-should comparison. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And is-is is the way, the only way humans develop. There is no other way. If you think by comparing somebody to somebody who's done it better through best practice is going to help somebody improve, no.
It's not going to work.
It's not going to work. You might learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there will be a little bit of an influence. You might go, wow, they did it really, really well. And you might not be hurt by it.
Mm.
But if you look at the current state of modern society and where a lot of people are, young, old, in the way they are continuously compared, online, magazines, no matter where you look, social media, you see we currently have a bit of an issue with self-worth and where people are. So, and very often that discussion or that feeling has been created through people being compared to something unintentionally, indirectly, always through continuous sort of media consumption. And there are lots of illusions being sold, and lots of which are really lies. They're lies, they're massive lies. By getting up and doing a 10-minute meditation in the morning, doing your yoga rounds, doing everything that you need to do, eat your right porridge, is not going to make sure that you have a beautiful day. And it's not going to make sure that you're going to get everything done. No, that's a big fat lie. The only thing that will help you decide on what you get done is when you decide what you don't want to do.
As a person.
As a person.
As an individual.
As an individual. As
myself.
Yeah. Yes.
And so this goes back to this comparison, looking at someone else, trying to see, all right, this guy, girl, whatever person does yoga in the morning and is performing well. So I'm going to do yoga in the morning, which means I should perform well, right? It doesn't make sense because I don't see that person as a person and I don't see myself as a person, because for that person, yoga might mean something completely different than it means to me. And only when I then I can see that person and get inspired, maybe take some actions. But it's about the framing of that comparison, essentially.
Well, make it very simple, because you get then theoretical, don't you? What it is your strength is not what you're good at. Your strength is what you find love in. That's it. So when you find love in something you do, then that's where it begins. So your job as a leader then is, well, look, I know that you can't take care of people's private lives, but the interesting thing is, some of the best leaders I've met and the ones that I've been around and the ones I see which are most successful today are the ones who have the ability to do that. They're able to, they don't point it out to you, they don't help you find it, but they encourage you to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And they give you the space to find it.
Mm-hmm.
They allow you to make the mistakes so you can find it. And that's the interesting thing, isn't it? That when you come back to then any organization, on the one hand, they should be making money. They can't make too many mistakes, otherwise the business will go bust. But I think they confuse a number of things. They confuse the fact that running the business and making profit has a lot to do with humans learning about who they are in their role by mistake and getting to be the best person they can be in their role. So the product gets impacted and the product becomes the best product and we can sell it to our customers better. And the thing is, if the employee or team experience is amazing in their development, believe me, then the customer experience is even better. And that's what leaders are there for. Their job is to create experiences. And remember, every experience is individual, it's personal, and it's bottom-up.
Mm.
You cannot be forced to have an experience. And what we're currently doing is we're trying to force an experience, aren't we?
Yes.
Like you just described so beautifully.
Yes.
By, I've copied somebody, and I'm going to do the same, and the same effect. No? So the question really is what do you find love in? Where do you find you zone out, and you're in, you're in flow? Where do you find you belong? Where do you find you fit in? And where you don't fit in, it's also maybe time to also sit down and reflect. Why don't you?
It's one of these learning opportunities.
It's a learning opportunity. It's to understand.
Data.
Yeah, data. And that's where I'm fascinated. That's why I always come back to data. I always like find what sort of data matters. And spent a lot of time looking at this and looking at how do you ask questions? How do you then get to this data? And we found that the data you don't need is evaluation data for humans. Data that evaluates humans.
In terms of revenue or growth or what data are you talking about?
We're looking at humans, aren't we? So comparing revenue is fine.
Hmm.
There's no human involved in there.
True.
But if I say to you, I'll ask you a question like, does your team lead listen to you? Yes, no. That's evaluating another human.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah? And then all the team leads get evaluated amongst themselves. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly there's a leader at the bottom. You've already got conflict in the question.
Mm-hmm.
You've already got some sort of friction and tension in the question.
Comparison.
A comparison again. So that's what I mean. Evaluation data leads to blaming data. That's what it leads to. It leads to blaming data. With humans. You can compare an industry. You can compare the revenue in Spain and England. But if you do that objectively, then it's okay. That's fine.
Mm.
If you look closely at the data and say, look, why is Spain You know, or like, let's turn it around. Let's say, why is England 45% behind Spain in revenue? Then you could have a healthy discussion around that and see, well, look, is it a market issue? What are the variables involved? Mm-hmm. What's going on? You can have quite a good discussion. But if you get to the people level, then the question should not be based on data, on revenue data, should
mm-hmm.
it? It should be based on things like, I would say, formative data. So formative data is any data that helps you to shape the future.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting. It's, okay, so what do we want here with our people? Where do we want to move this organization from where it was this year to next year? And where can we get this formative data from? We want generative data. Generative data helps you to generate ideas, concepts, like in a focus group. Yeah? And then you have what they call, I've said now formative data, and I've said generative data, and then you have learning data. So data that helps you learn what's going on. So, okay, this is an opportunity here. Here is a learning opportunity. And hey, here's our star card. What can we learn from our best thing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do we need to scale it? Do we need to do something else? So that's what you start getting into, and you start, well, where can I get this data? And it brings it back to this healthy high performance. So if you're looking at healthy high performance or healthy high functioning teams, then you want to see, well, if we could get flow data that is generative, formative, and learning.
Flow data, you mean how much time our employees spend in flow
states? Yeah, exactly. They can learn, improve their flow at an individual level and mm-hmm. a collective level. So, you know, are you overwhelmed as a team at the moment? And when you are, what happens? What do we need to stop doing, start doing, change, continue to do? That means that data has to have continuous cadence. And that's what we then, and that becomes very, very interesting. But we're nowhere near getting that data, because we continuously look at things like engagement. And engagement is a wonderful concept. You know, being psychologically engaged in something is nice. But if you're not, it's too late. So if you know 60% of your team is disengaged, wouldn't it be nice to know it was going to happen?
Definitely.
So you could act before it happens? And that's where we come back to, once again, the elements we found about teams and individuals and about how people develop. And coming back to your concept of realities, that everybody has their own individual reality. They don't even know themselves. Yeah, well, because we keep telling them, we keep conditioning and saying, we always have this model of success, don't we? A very simple model. That's the model of success. Follow that. And best practice. We don't want best practices in a complex world. We need emergent practices. So how do we set up any learning system, any learning team, any learning environment where it's about what's emerging out of a human?
Mm-hmm.
You come in and today you feel angry and upset and fucked off about the world. So what do I have to say as a teacher to you? So Raphael has a better day today. It may not be the best day today. Maybe I cannot help you today. But at least I can say, look, I understand you. I know where you're coming from. And you know what? Hold it. That's okay. Hold your anger. And work through it. Now go off and have a beautiful day. And then suddenly you start seeing young people move. There's an acceptance of somebody just being angry. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm allowed to have this emotion. Yeah. But I'd like you to take that with you. But you know you also have another emotion. The other emotion is that you can see a beautiful day. So go and have that as well. Then it's up to you to decide, do I stay angry all day? Or do I then pick the emotion of saying, I'm going to perceive this day as a beautiful day? What do you want to do?
So before we dig a bit into how can we practically do all the things you've just mentioned, because I think that's quite challenging. Are you aware of how revolutionary these ideas are that you just presented?
I don't think they are. I think they're very old. They just haven't done. We haven't put them into action. I'm using concepts from people like Alfred Adler, 1923.
That's pretty old, yes.
No, it's, you know, if there's a book you want to read, then it's a book like The Courage to be Disliked, a Japanese book. It's a conversation between two people. And it basically brings all of Alfred Adler's concepts to life, and I am a big believer of them.
Mm-hmm.
And one aspect I really, really enjoy about Alfred Adler is this concept of vertical and horizontal relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that really, really matters there is that if you build your job on a daily basis as a human, if you go around building vertical relationships, yeah, vertical relationships are based on the concept of praise. I praise you for the good work you
mm-hmm.
do. Let's make this person a leader again. Well done, Rafael. You are getting good at writing those reports. There is an implicit message in there by saying you're almost as good as me. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Look, you know, I've praised you. And people say, I want more praise. I don't want to give anybody praise. Because the other side of praise is I also have the power to punish you.
Yes.
Praise and punishment go hand in hand. And that's where it's broken.
That doesn't sound psychologically safe.
Mm. Well, the thing is, remember kindness again? Sometimes you have to say something about something. So how do you do it? How do you give? If you give people feedback based on the concept of a vertical relationship, then it comes across as praise or punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Then you call it critical feedback. It's rubbish.
Yes.
What you have to do as a leader is understand how to create horizontal relationships, eye-to-eye relationships. Yeah, that's what Alfred Adler called. And the only language you can use there is encouraging language. So I spend some time with some of the leaders I accompany and coach in creating that encouraging language. So how do I give critical feedback to somebody, but in an encouraging way? So afterwards, they don't feel praised or punished.
Mm.
What they feel is, that really helped me. I think I'm going to go away and try this. I'm excited to have a go at this now.
How do I do it?
Well, the thing is, it's the language you use. So one way, what very often is you sit down and you ask the person questions. You say, so how did you experience it? What happened when you wrote this report? First of all, get data first. And based on that data, then you'll find the encouraging words. Oh, wow. God, I didn't know that your flat was so noisy. Then why didn't you come into the office? You don't have a key? What do you mean you don't have a key? Oh, wow, look, I've got to encourage you in some ways to understand that when you need help, that you've got to get in contact with me. How can I make, you know, how do I bring that across to you?
Mm.
And then you have a conversation around this, and it leads towards you finding the right words to say. You just don't find the words like that. But I think it's a conversation you can have, and you get better and better at it. That's the way, I find.
So, from what we've talked about so far, is correct me if I'm wrong, but I got a very leader-centric approach to changing organizations, and that to creating a space that's psychologically safe, where you feel belonging, and where the employees or members of a team, whoever it might be, can even be students in a classroom, right?
Yes.
To experience flow. So is that correct? Is it the role of a leader to do that? How can I, if anyone who's listening is an individual in a classroom sitting there, yes, I want those three things. I want this in my classroom, but I'm a student. I'm up to... against, I have 10 different teachers every day that don't know jack shit about this concept and are probably not even willing to learn about it. They're not open-minded. Painting the devil on the wall. I know there are a lot of engaging and inspiring teachers out there, but how do I actually make that change happen? How can I move an organization, a team in that direction?
It starts with the people who have the power. If it's set up like that, then it starts with the people who have power.
Hmm.
And it's also realizing from all the young people in the organization, when the leadership sees them as people they can learn from,
mm-hmm.
then it's easy. Then it becomes everybody's responsibility. Do you understand? So there is this idea of, you know, I don't think school systems or organizations are any different there. You know, there is one thing that is leadership's responsibility, and that is the sense of belonging. Leadership provides direction, but it has to be inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I always see belonging is it's everybody's responsibilities, but leadership begins with it because they set the stage.
Mm-hmm.
If they set the stage for the sense of belonging, then everybody can embrace it. So it does start with the teachers. So any student sitting here thinking, where do I begin? Well, start with your mates and your friends. So when you guys study together, then start close.
Mm-hmm.
Don't think about changing the whole classroom. Mm-hmm. But work with your friends. Make sure you guys have a great environment.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how to navigate maybe a classroom that's difficult. What are the best strategies in each and every classroom? How does this teacher deal with their test? So it's starting very, very small always. We never start big, start small. With yourself and your environment and your friends. And the group you belong to, your classroom. So there are certain concepts that work really well, don't they? You have like the person who speaks and who stands for all the students in the year.
Mm.
Or is the speaker in the classroom you're in. And it's about setting those up properly. And then working with them. I think the fundamental change we've got to do, really, is actually starting off with something very, very simple. Getting teachers a higher status in society.
Mm-hmm.
And then also on top of that, getting them some training and continuous development in the area of leadership, because they don't get it. They don't know how to create environments like that. There is no training in here. It's a developmental process, and it mm-hmm. takes time. You start as a young teacher. You're having fun. You're dedicated. Your classroom, your students love you. Your pupils love you. They see you as a fantastic person. You're 7 years in. You get tired of it. 8 years in. You get tired. There's no more development. That's it. You keep doing the same stuff. You may go up a year. You might go down a year. You might go up 3 years. There's some variation in content, but nothing ever really moves. And if you're the sort of person, and you do have them, you're excited by each and every human in your classroom and you get to know them, and there are teachers out there that do that.
Yes.
Then you're going to have a great life. You're going to have thousands of people that you've inspired, thousands of people that will always remember you as a teacher and always come back to you when you're 24, 26, also present you their children later on in life. They said, look, this is one of my best teachers. This was my science teacher. Or this was my English teacher. Or this was my French teacher.
You got a person like that?
Yeah, my biology teacher, some of my sports teachers, drama teacher. Miss Roberts was one of our physics teachers. I had amazing teachers. They inspired me. They just created interest and we flew. We flew. Inflow. So we had fun.
Hmm.
And you learn. You are in this mode of like, I can be like this. I want to be like this. I want to be like her. I want to be like him. You left the school and you were excited. And there were other days when you felt shit because you just had one bad teacher after the other. But that's what I mean. So it's about getting in there and saying, yeah, it's not a simple answer because I could not change a classroom. But what I can change is what's close to me.
Mm.
And start there.
Okay.
And there's one special thing about belonging which everybody can begin with. Belonging is what creates resilience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your individual resilience. There is no individual resilience. Resilience begins in the group. So making sure that you have good people around you and you're connected and you work at that will give you resilience and that will see you through any environment. Even if it's a terrible environment at school, it will see you through it.
That's, I think, very important and practical advice essentially there that every single student out there could use, every single employee that doesn't belong at the moment. You can create it for yourself in your nearest circle, in your closest friends and colleagues.
That's what keeps you going.
Hmm.
And it's interesting because it shouldn't be this sort of like, I've got to do it. No, it should be there. And you should question yourself if there aren't friends there. You should question yourself if you don't have people around you. You should question yourself if you're alone. Now, there is the other side of it. One thing I do know is currently bullying, exclusion, is a big topic in all the schools around Europe. And it's created through the idea of performance, which is broken. Yeah. And another part of it is this whole idea of it's your responsibility to fit in. So the cultural fit is the problem. And the other side is the model of performance, that you're an A-grade student.
Mm.
So those two things is what's currently creating a lot of the issues, I find. Because what happens is people then who do not perform, like schools or the education system want people to perform, and they're a bit different, get excluded. And the other side is this whole idea of fitting in. And if you can't fit in, then you are the issue. Why can't you fit in? Change yourself. No. Set very clear principles on we enjoy diversity. We are a diverse group. It's a fact. And therefore, we have to create fair environments. If somebody is excluding somebody because they like manga, or somebody else is excluding somebody because they're a bit different,
they wear glasses,
or whatever, you know, for whatever reason you were bullied or taken the piss out of, or for whatever reason somebody hurt you psychologically or physically, or made you feel like, it's got to be a clear line. And at the moment, very few are good at it.
Mm.
And they cannot do it without blame. That's the problem. How do you create those environments where it's very, very clear? Allow people to be who they're allowed to be. Let their realities be. And I will not tolerate it.
Yes.
And they don't. They don't do it. That's why lots of young people struggle in schools. And that's why they turn off. And when teachers say, well, you've got to find your motivation, you can't. If I put any human into an environment where they're not happy, it won't take long. It will destroy you. So it's all rubbish talk. And I don't care what teacher says it to me. That it's, you know, there's some responsibility on the student. No, there isn't. It's your responsibility to create, as a school, an environment which is integral, which is, has ethics in it, and which knows how to make it inclusive and allows everybody to be.
Mm. So a lot of stress on the teachers there and their role.
Stress. I think that's one of the biggest, saddest concepts I find. Then if teachers are stressed, then there's something going wrong.
Mm.
Stress is a signal of we need to do something different.
It's data.
It's data for me.
Mm.
Whenever I'm stressed, I then look at myself. I go to the doctor. I say, what's going on? Why am I stressing myself? That I have to stop, think. Maybe you have to stop first, feel, then think, and then do. So I disagree. What I do agree with is teaching and being around young people year after year and making sure that you're there for their needs is hard work.
Mm.
And it can break you.
And especially if that organization, that school, doesn't provide you with that environment yourself, that you should provide to the
That the teachers
students.
Are not teams.
Yes.
The teachers are not working together. That teachers are not set up in a way that they work in cohorts or whatever structure you want to put up.
Mm.
But the whole job, I think, today of any system or structures, make it school system, will be to set up the school organization in such a way that teachers feel they've got their backs covered.
Mm.
And they align on certain things. There's a certain way of working. Mm. And what is our common language of conflict?
Yes.
When there are tensions, when things are not working in the school, how do the teachers bring it to the table so all teachers can see this is the way we deal with this?
So are they kind or are they nice?
Yeah, well, the thing is, and there's continuity and consistency. So for me, leadership is not about the big things. It's about the small things done well, consistently.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you go to one classroom and it's a different way of working, different grades. The teacher treats you differently. You go to the next one. Just imagine if I worked in an office and each and every part of the office where you worked, it was different rules and different ways of working, you'd die. And that's what happens in schools. The kids just have to manage that.
Mm.
And what schools have never been good at, and maybe I'm talking of Austria at the moment, maybe I'm talking of all of the school systems, is how do you create that continuity? So everybody knows across the board, plus, minus 5-10%, it's about the same.
Mm.
And fairness is not only correlated, being treated fairly is not only correlated, but is a causal connection to performance. If you feel treated fairly, you perform.
Wow.
If you don't, you give up. You procrastinate. You do all sorts of things to avoid. Because you're not being treated fairly. You spend a lot of time trying to work out why you're not being treated fairly. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with equity, which is part of belonging. So do you create a fair environment through your leadership? Or do you, without you knowing, through biases, show preference for a certain group of people and not for the others?
Mm-hmm.
And that comes back to Alfred Adler again, doesn't it? The vertical relationship versus the horizontal relationship.
Ties in perfectly.
Can you see that and how it all then starts connecting?
Yes.
So how does that all play out when you do a workshop? So what's the first thing you do to ensure that everything we talked about in the last sort of half an hour happens within milliseconds? How do you open up a space as a leader for the first time on the first day? You've got 20, 30 kids in the room. What's the first thing you do? So all of that happens at the same time. See? And it will be different in each and every classroom with each and every teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But if teachers are able to do that and feel capable of doing that and can inspire every first day of the term, then you'll see an education system changing.
Yes. The whole thing changes.
The whole thing will change.
Yes.
The whole thing will change.
And now you've made it quite simple.
Mm.
Might not be easy, but it's simple.
That's something to think about. Walk in. What's the first thing you would do, Raphael?
If we ask them how they are, where they come from.
That could be your thing.
Yes.
I'd walk in, and get them to move the tables out of the room. And then I'll say, sit down. Let's sit on the floor together. And do something. And ask them, why did I just do that? I'd make sure that we do something very, very different each and every time. And next year I'll do something else.
Mm.
And I'll tell them a sad story very often. A story that hurt me.
Personally?
Yeah. A story that got me. About being young. About it being a pain.
Mm.
And the things that are currently on my mind.
Which creates both psychological safety and might even
connect with someone. Eye to eye.
Yeah.
And then I'll also then bring in a ritual and say, I want to start a ritual. I don't know how this ritual looks like yet. But I want to do it every 6 weeks with all you. And it will be done like this.
Mm.
And we'll eat a cake together. And we'll talk about the things that make us cry, make us laugh, and make us happy. And today you'll be looking at me and thinking, what is this dick doing? And lots of teachers then look at me and go, well, you can't do this, you can't do that. And I say, well, I have. I've lectured for many years and I've worked with young people and I've done it. I just do it. And each and every time some students struggle with me, they generally come back later and say, I get you now. Mm. But the only goal of the first session you have with your first day is to make sure when they leave the room, they're on this polarity of either being like, I don't know what happened here, what the fuck, or is this teaching, what is this? So confusion of some sort, which is the best thing to be in, or the other side, completely inspired and thinking, he gets me.
Also not a bad outcome for a first session with a class.
And that's what I mean. Each and every space you create, you walk into. What are the simple things that make it work?
Hmm. Really want to say that these are simple things, but they're not easy.
No.
I don't think they're
easy. No, because you got to know yourself.
You got to know yourself. You got to open up, be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in a lot of classes, and they can be hard on you. Children can be hard on you.
Yeah, and they should be. It's good.
Yes.
It's all right. Let us show you a mirror. It's fine. Yeah. But I mean, that's one of the things, is being able to set the room and make sure they respect you.
Mm.
And respect for me isn't they say, oh, you look horrible today, Imran. That's no disrespect.
No.
It's just somebody...
Stupid comment.
It's a comment. Yeah. Not even stupid, it's a comment.
Fair enough.
Maybe they're right.
Yeah. Maybe they're right, yes.
But do you know what I mean? It's one of those things when you walk into a room and you've got these young people around you and you're facing them, you're standing up and getting, you know, you're standing there. I mean, no, don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more important to be able to read the room, hold the space, and it's something we're not taught. Not one teacher I know has ever been taught how to read a room, what's going on, sense things out, and then hold space. And holding space comes back to creating third spaces. The first thing you learn to be able to create a third space is by holding space.
Can you give some practical insights on what you mean by that?
Well, holding space, think about it. Let's think about a situation, typical situation at a party. That might be easier. Start with somewhere.
Mm.
Yeah, you and me. We've never met before. And the first question you ask me is...
How do you do?
No, you say, where do you come from originally?
Fair enough.
And I look at you. And now I can answer you. Inside, I might feel a little bit annoyed.
Mm.
And I think, well, I give this person, but I also have to give you the benefit of the doubt. So, yeah, this could be a wonderful person. He's had a couple of glasses of wine.
Mm.
And I could then look at you and said, and what do you mean by that question? And you look at me. You answer. And you give me an answer and say, well, you know, I'm just interested in where you come from. And said, yeah, so tell me more about that question. What prompted you to ask me that question first? And hold space. And keep holding until you go red.
Mm.
Until the person opposite you starts saying, well, what the fuck's going on in this conversation? I don't understand it. And it'll get uncomfortable for both of us. But the key thing is to hold, is to be empathetic. To show your empathy, to show your compassion, to show that you care about this conversation. Like, I really care. I just want to make sure where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm. I think I get it. It's about stopping time, essentially.
Yeah. That's what you do.
Yes.
And if you can do that with people in dog zones, if you've got a dog, at the supermarket, if you just meet somebody, at a conversation, at a table where you just met somebody, wherever you do it, just hold space. When somebody says a comment that you don't like or a comment that's different from what you think, and at the same time also learn to read the room. And then, if you can start doing that, then you'll be able to also then do what they call classroom management. And I think that's one of the hardest things to get your head around as any teacher. I think it's one of the things we should continuously work on is how to hold a room in the sense of how to manage a room. Mm. You know, if they're noisy, if they come in one day and the news has shown that this is going to happen in the school because of Corona. The teachers have had to deal with a lot over the last 2 years. And I think classroom management skills were not up to it. And I don't think there's one parent, I don't think there's anybody out there who could have done a better job either. So let's get this right. This is not a criticism of the teachers.
Mm.
This is just showing how little emphasis we put on it. And in fact, going forward in a very complex world, classroom management skills are going to be the most important.
For society as a whole.
Yeah, just yes. All of us.
Yeah.
And people are not good at it. We're not good at it.
And it comes all back to what you said, what we've talked about the previous hour. It's about creating spaces, not only as teachers, but also for teachers.
Mm.
So every individual who has any role in education has a responsibility in this. And
yes,
it's the parents creating a space for teachers to make mistakes, to be human. It's the headmasters, the principals, creating schools, setting them up for teachers to perform in well. It's the teachers themselves trying to create teams, trying to understand themselves as teams in schools. Then it's about the teachers themselves and
yep.
The way they think and the way they are either nice or kind to their students, also their colleagues and their superiors. And it's also about the students themselves. So for them to find out, where can I find belonging? Where can I find flow? Where can I have the psychological safety in a space that I can actually impact? And if you break it down like that, to me, it doesn't, most people might disagree, but to me, it doesn't sound like a hard task anymore, because it's about how I think as an individual and how I treat the people around me and how I create these horizontal relationships. And all of a sudden it all clicks together and makes perfect sense.
There you go.
And I think it's intuitively right what you're talking about. Why do I then feel guilty about being who I am and about trying to be who I am in these environments?
Well, because there is this continuous picture of there being a perfect student. There is this model, and that model we need to get rid of. And we need to realize there isn't. Everybody has their strengths and understanding.
Yeah.
That's why your work is so important around strengths. You know, if you can help people find where they find, you know, in what they find their love in, then you will definitely move. And I think there are people here, like, you know, you're doing some great work. I mean, is it Ali Mahoji who's been doing a lot of work around that as well? Around,
yes.
Isn't the German word, like, you know, Zwischenfalten and Faltetisch?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, and that work around there, which is all about finding yourself, flourishing and thriving and finding your way. So I think there's going to be some movement happening. I think there is a realization that people are not being needy, people are not being want more. What people want is to become who they need to become. And
emerge.
And then as they do that, how can our school systems, how can our education systems, how can our organizations, how can our companies, how can governments, how can societies help that person find an existence in which they are happy? And that will benefit everybody. It will be more health in the environment. Overall, there'll be, you know, it will lead to good stuff. Overall, it will lead to good stuff. And it's what we've all been craving for, this moving away from this, you know, this very sort of, we've brought it from colonial times, of the way we treat humans, that this is the way you treat humans. And it's not. Nature has done an amazing job in the way we learn and what we are and how we exist and how we grow and how we develop as humans. And I think our job is to make sure we have collaborative, inclusive environments in which we can unfold and become who we need to become. That's all it is. I think you do that, and it's scaling.
So all that
and the thing is, let me get this right. I don't mind sitting here with you with a glass of wine and theorizing and thinking about how to get out of the status quo. That doesn't work. You cannot think yourself out of the status quo. The only way you can do it is by doing something. So try something, the system will give you data, and then change. And keep doing that. That's the only way to move out of status quo. So if there's any piece of advice I can give somebody, is stop sitting around tables and talking. Go in tomorrow and start something. Do something different tomorrow.
Embrace mistakes as data points.
Well, as learning. Well, just, I would say your job is to perform, and the other side of it is to learn fast. And that learning means that when you hit something, frame it as a learning problem or a learning opportunity, however you want to use your language, I don't care. But think yourself out of the status quo.
Yes. And it's funny.
Doesn't work. Yeah, thinking out of it, you can't think yourself out of the status quo. You'll never be able to.
No. It's funny what we talked about making mistakes, getting data, learning. These are fundamental principles of pedagogues in their daily work. So teachers learn these principles and use them in their daily practice. I've talked with a teacher on the podcast too. And one thing that she stressed about creating this environment for students to thrive and actually learn is how you treat mistakes. Because they're part of school. Right, you learn something, you make mistakes.
Well, are children treated fairly when they make mistakes?
Yes.
And they're not.
They're probably not. And
so you're going to make sure when a mistake happens, it's going to be treated fairly. If you have a fair. So for me, it's even more than not the way mistakes are treated. It's about, is it a fair environment?
Yeah. No.
Because that is causal.
Definitely.
To every human's performance.
Yeah. Yet the system is, the more mistakes you make in school, the worse you are, the worse grades you get, which means the less of a person you are. That's the message that the school system gives you.
Yes, that's it. It's exactly that. You lose your self-worth. And then if you look at then other, you know, it leads to all sorts of syndromes. And children feel they're just doing everything wrong then, young people. It doesn't matter what I do, I'm going to be wrong anyway. So let me give up. And then they expect then extra effort. And you think, no, you aren't, because the school system inherently is doing the wrong thing. So how do you set up? How do you set up a system where mistakes are necessary and children are supposed to make mistakes and learn? And then how do you separate it from the tests? Because the things that have the biggest impact are the tests.
Yes.
So kids don't get put down when, don't get, they're not broken because they've done a project together and there's mistakes in the project and the teacher goes through with them and says, look, this is what you could do better here next time. Da, 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 and they learn the fine. It's when they get graded that the mistakes hurt. So what do you do? What could schools do differently? What could schools... And there's lots you can do. There's loads. There's loads and loads and loads you could do.
I think we could fill up another 2 hours of conversation about...
But it is what it is. But I think there could just be... Currently, I'm just looking at how could you make it a better experience with the system it is.
Hmm.
That's the thing that matters to me most at the moment. Yes. That's the thing, how could we separate that when people do tests and they get things marked wrongly, that it's not seen as part of their personality and who they are.
Yeah.
If the schools did something there, that would be amazing.
Yes.
But saying, look, we do tests, but tests mean this.
Hmm.
And we want to make sure very clear, representation of who you are and a person and your future and where you're heading. You might not do well here this year, it's okay, but in the future you'll be all right. Don't worry. And we want to be here to support you so we can improve this.
The important part is showing up, essentially.
Do you know what I mean? That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
And then next step would be to say, if you get an F and your neighbor gets an A, there's no comparison necessary or maybe even possible between those two. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter for who you are. And it doesn't tell you anything about yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's something quite easy to do for a teacher, right? It's essentially saying what you just said. It's one sentence that you can tell your students.
For me at the moment, the most fundamental question is this one. Is like, how do we help our young people to manage the current system? It is, because we got it. This is it. It's what we have.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with it? How do you live with it on a daily basis? How do you build the resilience in the group? And as a teacher, you can do that.
Yes.
And if the classroom comes together and feels stronger, then they will be able to deal with all the ups and downs. And as long as there's no, psychological sort of scarring, I'm all for it. The minute you get into areas of psychological scarring, which teachers, we do as well, then I think then we go start thinking about what is really broken here and stop it. But I don't think that happens most of the time. Most of the time you can deal with it. That's where I am. Sorry, it's my daughter just sent me a message. And I just want to reply back to her because she just called me. And I want to ask her if she's okay.
Do it.
I'm going to do that very, very quickly.
I'm glad that this is a space for you where you feel comfortable enough.
Because I saw her name, that's the only reason I'm answering. Otherwise, I would have left it.
Mm.
Sorry about that, Rafael.
Don't you worry. So, do you have any recommendations on what books one could read to dive further into these topics? And maybe you can split it up for students, for teachers, and leaders in organizations, maybe headmasters or any sort of leadership level in any organization.
Well, for leaders and organizations, I would then definitely go for any book by Amy Edmondson on psychological safety.
Okay.
Any book, her last two books are good. I think that's not a bad one. And then there is, you said for organizations, I've got leaders.
For teachers.
Or for teachers? Well, that's a good question now. What book would I recommend today? How to be an anti-racist.
How to be an anti-racist.
I think that's a book most teachers need to read. Because I think it's the same way that you just cannot not be racist. By just saying I'm not racist is not enough.
And I think there needs to be a massive upskilling in how to create inclusive environments. And it begins by understanding what it is to be anti-racist. Like, to be more resilient, you have got to be, it's called anti-fragile. You've got to become anti-fragile. You've got to do more than just, say, ignore something. So how do you be more anti-racist? And that means also when you see people who come in and have a different accent to you, and then you use your bias starts working. Do you understand? So anything around that would be a real helpful point to begin to understand how to create a third space and more inclusive environments. That's the basis of where all the little microaggressions are created in classrooms. The racist comments, the sexist comments, the ableisms, all the little things that hurt people, and where the stories begin and where the students and the pupils never forget. So for them, and for the younger ones, no, just keep holding up books to your teachers and say, read this. If anything, I would tell young people, you don't need to change. You need to hold up the mirror to us so we get better at creating environments. You don't need to do anything. Just hold the mirror up to us and say, look, it's your job to create a better environment. You haven't done a bad job, but it can be improved. And I'm willing to give you data. I am a sensor in the system. And please use me like a sensor, because I will provide you good data. Sometimes it might be angry. Sometimes I might say something stupid. But look, if you really listen to me, we will provide you the data that you need to give us the best experience. And then, do you know what? We will also start understanding where you're coming from. Because at the moment, we don't.
We truly don't. Just one more, one follow-up to that. What I see happening at the moment is a movement towards tribalism in all sorts of ways of thinking, of ideas, of spaces, be it environmentalism, be it anti-vaccination, but also students themselves, they are sort of this, or are at least perceived or portrayed in the media as this tribe that's angry against the school system, against teachers, against schools. So what am I as a student allowed to do? Do I have to be kind in how I hold up that mirror? Or would you say, no, young people, you do it, you just let it out, hold up that mirror the way you feel it? Or is there some advice you could give young people there?
Don't let any... No, there is going to be... I want dialogue. And it can be hard dialogue, and it can be difficult dialogue. But give face. Make sure whatever you do, give face. Be angry, be upset. Show your emotions. Nobody's going to shut your emotions down. But give face. You have to give face. You could say hard words, but give face. And give face is really, really important, because you can't have a dialogue if each party is not giving face. And that is this irony, this sarcasm, all these little underlying sort of things of knowing better, building the vertical relationship all the time by using your position of power. A dialogue isn't, you don't use your position of power when you're in dialogue. What you do is you create a space where you're eye to eye and you say, hey, look, these are things we don't say to each other, and this is the way. Be able to moderate this world. So give face. If you're going to do one thing, if you're angry, show you, I've got no problems you being angry, upset, do it in the words you want to do it in, swear. But give face. Give the person in front of you face. Like I said in the party, if I was to meet you, we might be uncomfortable, but I have to make sure of one thing. That you feel comfortable. You're going, hey, this is an interesting conversation. Where is he going? Why is he being a dick? Why is he not letting, why is he just not saying where he comes from originally? And you understand, but I hold that space. I make sure that you don't lose face.
Yes.
Because if you lose face, then that wasn't a dialogue, that was domination.
Yeah.
There's one thing. And I don't care what you wear, how you do it, how you bring it across, don't care. But make sure you give face.
So, you're a dog person.
Yeah.
What can we learn from docs about life, about teams, about doing things? Is there any interesting insight in observing dogs?
Yeah, there is. There's something that, you know, a dog will... You have to make the dog decide for you. So a dog will either pull you, push you, do everything, and it's in control. Or you have to work with a dog and build the trust. And that's the biggest thing, give the dog trust. And saying, and waiting sometimes until the dog then looks at you and says, I'm ready. And then you go. And you've got to keep doing that, then years on end. Until the dog then follows you. Because they decide to follow you.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that's what we, that's a bit one of the biggest things I've learned, that the dog didn't improve, I improved.
That's a wonderful way of looking at it.
Yeah, I improved. I improved. The work was on me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, becoming a good father is not speaking to your children. Becoming a good father is you working on yourself. Or mother, or brother, or sister.
Or leader, or teacher.
It's working on yourself.
Yeah. It all ties back in.
Yeah. It always does.
Wow. I don't know if there's a better way to end it, this conversation. There probably is. But thank you so much, Imran. We've talked about so many things that all came back to one thing after all, or two, three things. It's about the way how you think, it's about building horizontal relationships, seeing eye to eye in every interaction you have, be it in at home, in your business,
exactly,
in the classroom. And you've inspired a lot of thinking in me, a lot of data gathering. I have to go back and reflect and learn and see on how I can take these things and put them into practice, actually, because there's a lot there in this short little conversation. And I'm sure there's a lot more we could talk about.
Thank you.
And yes, I'd be happy to talk to you again someday about all the things we started on.
Yeah, brilliant. I'd love to come back and keep the conversation going. I'm learning, I'm learning as I go as well. And that's another part that Marine at Mummies, that we're all learning on the go.
Mm.
And I think that learning on the go is something we don't speak enough about. You know, I think I keep realizing that everybody learns in a different way. But overall, learning is learning. Mm-hmm. But the interesting part I find is this, when people are given something new in the second and what they do with it. And I find that learning on the go is fascinating. I think we're all doing that at the moment, Raphael. And I think that's the most, that's why these conversations are so fruitful.
I think so too. It's like a little dance we play with words and thoughts.
In the third space.
Awesome. So thank you very much for spending your valuable time, and hope to see you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Imran Rehman. It left me with curiosity and wonder, but also doubt and questions. A lot of what we talked about makes intuitive sense to me. This conversation sends me on a quest to explore how to put these ideas into practice in learning environments that currently don't offer psychological safety, a sense of belonging, and opportunity for flow experiences. So that's probably quite a lot of learning environments out there. If you want to join me and Polarstern on this quest, follow us on Spotify, Instagram, Twitter, and or Facebook. You'll find us at Polarstern Wien. Links to Kokoro, Imran's channels, the mentioned books, and Kokoro's book club are in the description below. Now, let me leave you with some words from Imran Rehman. Your strength is not what you're good at. It's what you find love in. Thanks for listening, and hope to see you next time.